Let's look in John chapter 11 this morning and try to find some of these vital concepts and truths that we can find in these 57 verses, and then spend a little bit of time looking at the major theme that runs through this chapter. Just two truths that I want us to look at this morning. And this is a big one and an important one. And that is, when we look at Jesus, we don't see, when we pick up our New Testaments, we don't see Jesus as some kind of emotionless, stoic leader or person. And when you read John chapter 11, especially, you don't see that. You see Jesus as a caring and a compassionate Savior. Now notice how many times we see that in this chapter. We see it at the very beginning. In John chapter 11, starting in verse 1, says there was a man, a certain man, who was sick. His name was Lazarus. And this is not the same Lazarus we read about in Luke 16, who had died and gone on to paradise. This is a different Lazarus. This is the brother of Mary and Martha, who lived in Bethany. Verse 2 says, it was that Mary, his sister, who had anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. We're going to see that in the next chapter when we see that about Mary. Therefore the sister sent to Jesus, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Why didn't they say his name? I mean, how many people did Jesus love? It's interesting, they didn't say, Jesus, Lazarus of Bethany, Mary and Martha's brother. It's interesting that apparently the message that's brought is not filled with explanation as to who he is, other than the one whom you love is sick. Look down later in the chapter. That same phrase is used in verse 36 when the Jews saw how much Jesus loved him. This is in verse 3 and in verse 36. You have the same Greek word used about Jesus' love for his friend, and it's that Greek word phileo, from which we get the word Philadelphia, and we think of Philadelphia being the city of what? Brotherly love. That's the kind of love that's being expressed here, but it's not an emotionless love. Phileo love is a love that is tender and warm and compassionate and personal. That's the kind of love that Jesus had, not just for Lazarus, but for others, but it's specifically mentioned in this chapter that he had that kind of relationship with Lazarus. I want you to think about the relationship that you have with Jesus. Do you think that Jesus has a warm and tender and personal affection for you? You know, it's not just some nebula, you know, some feeling out here. Oh yeah, you know, I think I love that. Does Jesus have that warm and tender affection for you like he had for Lazarus? It's interesting that when the Jews looked at Jesus in verse 36, that somehow they recognized there was something observable about Jesus' love. Sometimes we think of love and we think it's just something we've got hidden. You know, it got hidden in our heart, and it's like that crush you had on that kid in the second grade or the third grade, and nobody else knew it except for you. It was that feeling that was inside. How did the Jews, they said, see how he loved him? There was something that they could see that was evident. When you think about the love that we're, this brotherly love, this phileo love, is it a love that's just tucked inside and nobody knows about it? By definition, it's not. It's not a love that we can hide and keep to ourselves. It is a love by its very nature that is expressed. It is a love by its very nature that requires it to be seen and to be known. Not so that we can get credit for it, but so that that love How do you think Jesus, how do you think Lazarus and Martha and Mary felt when they were with Jesus? What do you think Jesus did when he was with them to express his phileo love for them? Compassionate. How often had Jesus been to Bethany? You know, when he's described in verse 2 and 3, when he's described as being a friend of Jesus, how is it that these people were special friends to Jesus? Did he just pick them out? He's been in their home. Is there a better way to develop, to build, and to express phileo love than to have people into your home? You know, when God talks about showing hospitality and to do so without grumbling, how does that help? Does that help build relationships in the church to have people in your home? And if not, to have them into your home, to go to McDonald's together, to do something to spend. Jesus had been in their home. They had built a relationship so that all Mary and Martha, the only message they had to send was, "He whom you love is sick." And Jesus knew exactly what they were talking about. Did they ask Jesus to do anything in that message? Was there any request? No request. It's just information. Did they think Jesus might do something? Perhaps. But it was their need coupled with his love, and they were going to leave it up to Jesus to figure out what to do about it. So you've got this Greek word phileo used about Jesus' love in this chapter, but you also have the verb is agapao, the noun is agape, which is the word we use more often. You also have this agape love in this chapter, and it's in verse 5. Where it says that Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. I think it's interesting that the Bible chose to use, instead of the affection word, to use agape here. It's sickening to me to see what some of those have done, like what's his name, Brown, who wrote the Da Vinci Code, and others in that circle that have tried to make Jesus out to be some kind of character that he was not, especially with women. The word that God chose to put here about not just Lazarus, but Mary and Martha, was not the affection word. Do you think Jesus had phileo love, warm affection for Mary and Martha? Yeah. But God chose to put the word agape here and perhaps did it so that nobody could try to misconstrue Jesus' feelings towards Mary and Martha. But what is agape love? Now that it's on the screen. What is agape love? How is it different from phileo love? Say again. Okay, it's not based on emotion. It is not my emotion that is driving this love. So what is it? If it's not my emotion that's driving this love, if it's not my tender, warm affections, what causes me to have this love for somebody else?
It's a decision and an action versus a
feeling. Okay? It is a decision, it is a determination to act. When Jesus commands, when the Bible commands us, love one another. That's not phileo love. We need to have brotherly love for each other, but God does not command brotherly love because that's something that has to be developed, that has to be nurtured. But God commands us to have agape love. Yes, Tasha, and then Mary. Yeah, agape love, a good way to define it and to look at it is God love. And this was a special word. Not, it wasn't a special word. The historians tell us that the word agape was not as widely used until Jesus came along, and it was used abundantly in the church. It wasn't that they created a new word; it was in existence. But all of a sudden, God and Christians gave a whole new understanding to agape love. Mary? Yep. Love in spite of how somebody treats you. Love in spite of what they have done to you or what you might think about them. Lily? She's looking at three different Bibles up here. I'm trying to figure out what she's doing. Lily says it's a pure service, and that's agape love. Again, is not something, agape love cannot exist as something that's hidden within us, buried in our hearts, and nobody knows about it. It is an act of service. Fran had her hand up, and then June. Right, there was Mary Magdalene who he cast the demons out of. There were these special relationships. June mentions the apostle that we're reading what he wrote, and this is the book where he's called the disciple whom Jesus loved. And he did share a closer relationship with some, which you would anticipate. Do you have closer relationships with some brethren here than you do with others? It's almost like, you know, our relationships are like an onion that have various layers, and some people get a little bit closer than others, and maybe our relationships are like onions because some people stink or smell. I don't know. That's maybe not a good analogy for friendships, to think about the odor of an onion, but some of them are on an outer layer. Sorry to give that imagery to you, but some of them are not as close to the core, and some people we let closer than we do others. Somebody else had a hand up. Yes, ma'am.
I had my hand up, David.
Okay, hang on. Go ahead. Well, Jesus knew their hearts and could understand their needs. And this is what agape love is all about. Agape love is an unselfish love. Agape love does not look out for what I want, what I need in a relationship. Agape love, it's not a mirror that's pointed this way. Agape love is looking at others to see what is their need and what is it that is best for them. When Jesus says, love agape your enemies, are you supposed to have that warm, fuzzy feeling where you want to go and take them out and get a Danish and coffee together? I don't even like Danishes. But no, it's not commanding us to have warm affection for them. But it is commanding us, what is it that is best for them? What is it that's best? What's in the best interest of our enemies? What is it that's in the best interest of Christians? What is it that's in the best interest of the people in your home? What is it that's in the best interest of your employer or your employees? Our responsibility in agape love is to be unselfish. Take us out of the equation. To look out to others, what is it that are their needs? Not their wants, but what is it, especially their spiritual needs? And then there's action. And the action is, what am I going to do to meet that need? Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus. So we see Jesus as a caring and compassionate man, not just because he loved. But when he gets to the tomb of Lazarus, twice it says in verses 33 and 38 that Jesus, when he was there with the sisters, that he groaned. Now this is probably not like your husband groaning when you ask him to take out the garbage. All right? I'm not thinking this is the same kind of groan, you know, take out the garbage kind of groan. Verse 33, Jesus saw her weeping. And the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. New American Standard says that he was deeply moved in spirit. Dirk?
Knowing that he was going to raise Lazarus, it's hard to believe that groaning was for Lazarus, but it may have been for the sorrow of Mary.
That's it. Well, it was... Right. Dirk says he knew he was going to raise Lazarus. So, you know, is it groaning because, oh, no, someone is dead, like you would groan at a funeral? Or is it more for the grief of those who are there? And I think it was for the grief of those who were there. But this word groan, if I have it up here, the word groan, the Greek word conveys, and it has within it, the idea of anger and indignation. And what is Jesus angry with? Some people have read verse 33 and they've said that Jesus was angry with the Jews who were there and in their minds faking being upset. And, you know, they're the mourners, and so that's what they're supposed to do. But Jesus saw some kind of insincerity in them. I don't think he was angry with them. I think Jesus looked at this situation where he's got some of his best friends on earth, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. One of them has died. The death of one has caused the anguish and the grief of his other two friends. Is Jesus different than any other preacher in that situation? When Jesus would look at death, did Jesus know where death came from? Did Jesus know where death started? I think Jesus was angry at death, but not just at death, but he's angry because Satan and sin have brought this out. Why are Mary and Martha, his good friends, why are they grieving? Why are they weeping? The word weeping here means that they were wailing out loud. Why are they hurting so much? Because of death. Where did death come from? Because of Satan. I think Jesus looked at this and said, you know, if it wasn't for Satan, this wouldn't be happening right now. He's angry. But it's not just, it is a groan of sorrow for them. Dirk?
I think it's possible it's also for their lack of faith. If you read verse 40 and just put a little bit of emotion into that verse, it's like, said I not unto thee that if thou would believe, thou should see the glory of God? It's almost like, didn't you believe me when I told you that I'm from God, and hear your lack of faith?
Well,
there should be an element of that in there.
Well, there's what's interesting in this chapter is there is a development of faith. And remember, what's the purpose of miracles? What was the purpose of Jesus doing miracles? What was the purpose of the apostles doing miracles? To create faith. In John chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31, John says, these things have been written, these signs have been written, that you may believe. The purpose of these miracles was to help men to begin believing. And here's Martha. And in verse 27, nope, back up. In verse 21 and 22, Martha says to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Even at that point, even when she says in verse 22, whatever you ask of God, God will give you, she still is not thinking Jesus can get him back from the dead. Because Jesus says in the next verse, your brother will rise again. She says, oh, I know that's going to happen at the end of time. So what you see in this chapter is a development of faith. And so Dirk mentions verse 40, where Jesus says, you know, I told you if you would believe, you would see the glory of God. There's a development. It's helping them to progress in their faith. And so here's Jesus. He groans two times. He groans again in verse 38. I forgot. Verse 33 also says that he was troubled. That word means that he shuddered. There was some apparently external reaction where Jesus shook because of what was happening. And then he groans again down in verse 38. Jesus loved these people. He felt for these people. He groaned. And then, yes, ma'am. Michelle?
Have you ever thought about that maybe he did not, he felt and he shuddered all this because maybe he knew where Lazarus was and he did not want to bring him back to this earth, that maybe he was bringing him back from where heaven was?
It could be. It's an interesting thought. You know, if Jesus knew that if he knew that Lazarus had gone on to a place of paradise and now he's going to bring him back to earth, how would you like to be Lazarus? What's the deal, right? You know, I had everything going for me and now I'm back here. Lily? There is an element of learning to trust here, and you see it. You see baby steps of trust here. In verse 22, you see Martha with these baby steps of, I know whatever you ask of God, God will give you. But even in that baby step, her faith is in God, but it's not so much in Jesus at that point. The word ask that Martha uses in verse 22, there are different words for ask in the Greek language. One of them, one Greek word for ask would be one person asking another person something, but there were two equals in that conversation. But the word that's used for ask here in verse 22 is of an inferior asking a superior for something. And I don't know that Martha yet recognized the complete deity of Jesus. She had faith in God, and she knew that Jesus was doing some interesting things, but I think you've got some baby steps in her level of trust. Lily mentions verse 37. Verse 37 are these antagonistic Jews who were trying to get people to turn away from Jesus, and so they were trying to bring his miracles into question. Well, why wasn't he here to heal this guy to begin with? So you see a progression that in Martha, there's a development of trust and faith. But even in some of these Jewish leaders, if verse 37 are these antagonistic Jews, some of them were trying to call him into question. Look over in verse 45. After Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, what do you have in verse 45? Verse 37, some of them are trying to get people to not listen to Jesus and take their attention away from him. But after he raises Lazarus, many of the Jews who had come to Mary and to see the things Jesus did believed in him. There were antagonistic Jews in verse 37, but after they saw Lazarus raised, some of them, they could not honestly, these religious leaders, some of them could not honestly continue to say, this guy is a nobody. There's something about Jesus, because verse 45 says that they had seen the things that he did. What's the purpose of miracles? One of the purposes is to create faith. One more thing about Jesus and his caring, compassionate nature, and it's obvious because we know verse 35 maybe better than any other verse besides John 3:16 in this book. Jesus wept. And we think about that, well, that's the shortest verse in the Bible, but it's got one of the biggest messages in it. That Jesus comes to this earth and he's not some stoic, he's not set apart from everyone else, and it's not that he doesn't have feelings and emotions. Why did Jesus weep in verse 35? What did he see in verse 33? He saw his friends weeping. Have you ever gone to a funeral? Not with really any thoughts of weeping there, but you got there and you saw the emotion of the family and that caused your emotions to respond? You weren't thinking, you weren't planning on crying when you got there because you've been to a lot of funerals. But when you saw that family torn up, remember the word weeping in verse 33, this is a loud outcry. They're hurting. And the Bible says Jesus burst into tears. He burst into tears because he saw his friends there and he felt for them. And if you go and you read Hebrews chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, but especially Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, I like the old King James and the old American Standard that talks about that it was not possible that Jesus could not feel with our infirmities. Jesus was not only in all points tempted like we are, Jesus faced the situations that we face. And on this occasion, Jesus' emotions were there. And Jesus wept. One more truth really quick. And then I want to introduce the theme. We've got about 10 minutes. Just one more truth really quick. What we see in this chapter at the end of it is that God is in control. And His will cannot be thwarted in any way. Look at what happened. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. And we're going to see more of in chapter 12, the response of the people. In chapter 12, they're really trying to take him and to kill him at that point. And there's a real plot, not only against Jesus in chapter 12, but even against Lazarus himself. But you get to the end of chapter 11 after Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. And the Jews, verse 45 says, many of them believed. But look at verse 46. While many of them believed, but some of them did not. And these were the ones who went to the Pharisees and called the chief priests and the Pharisees together. And they said in verse 47, what shall we do? This man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. Oh no, we can't have that. If we don't do anything, these people are going to keep believing in him. We can't have that, because if that happens, the end of verse 48, the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. These Jews were growing increasingly angry and fearful of Jesus because they thought he was going to come along and spoil what they had. He was going to mess it all up. They were going to be out of a job. They weren't going to have the political influence they had. And they weren't going to have the individual influence that they had. Think about these religious leaders. Did they have an influence over the average Jew? Yeah, but if they keep going and believing him, they're not going to listen to us anymore. They're getting angry with him. So they're trying to figure out, all right, what are we going to do about this? So Caiaphas the high priest, and this is a passage that I think is maybe difficult. We don't understand it when we first read it. One of them, verse 49, one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. Well, that's a nice thing to say, right? Here they are saying, what are we going to do? This guy, he keeps, you know, if we don't do anything about him, everybody's going to believe on him. We're going to lose our influence. Caiaphas says, guys, you don't know what you're talking about. You know nothing at all. In fact, I think he's trying to say, you know, stop worrying. This is a little bit easier than you might think. Nor do you consider that it is expedient for, and you might have a different word after the word for here, depending on what translation you had, there, it might be a different pronoun there. It is expedient for us or for you. You're not understanding that it would actually be expedient for you or expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish. Caiaphas is saying, guys, think about this. You're worried that if he continues to grow and develop and these people follow him, you're worried that we're going to lose our influence and the Romans are going to come and take away. He says, but instead of letting this whole nation perish, hey, guys, what if just the one guy perishes? If just the one guy, if this one man should die, you know, if something should happen to him, You know, I'm not saying anything, but if something bad should happen, and if he dies, then the nation's okay. The nation's not going to be taken away by the Romans, because this one guy, we can just get rid of this one guy. Now, verse 51. Caiaphas, I think I've got this on the next slide, he said that Jesus should die, but Caiaphas was actually saying a little bit more than I think Caiaphas intended or thought that he was saying. You know, it's interesting sometimes that God can take that which is evil and turn it for his good. Do you see that happening anywhere in the Bible? Where God could take that which was evil and turn it for his good. Isn't that what Joseph said about his brothers and what they did to him? Threw him in a pit, sold him into slavery, went down and was a prisoner in Egypt. And Joseph says to his brothers at the end of the book of Genesis, what you intended for evil, God meant it for good. Can God take something that is evil and use it for his purposes? Here's what Caiaphas was saying. Guys, if this one man should die, then we'll all be okay. Caiaphas meant that in a vicious and vindictive way, but turn and look at it from God's perspective. If the one man, Jesus, dies, what will happen to the nation? It can be saved. Not because the influence of Jesus has been removed, but because the blood of Jesus has been shed in order that they might be saved. So now this, verse 51, now this he did not say on his own authority. But being high priest that year, he unknowingly apparently prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Caiaphas had done more than he thought or ever intended to do. But you'll notice that verse 53 lends itself to an understanding that this was Caiaphas' purpose. He was not trying to say, he was not trying to look at God's scheme of redemption and saying Jesus dies on the cross and he saves us from our sins. You see that Caiaphas was trying to be vicious in his intent, because verse 53 says, then they heard Caiaphas. Yeah, it's a good idea. Then from that day on, they plotted to put Jesus to death. Not put him to death so that he could save them from their sins. Put him to death so they can get rid of his influence out of the nation and save their own hide. God can take that which is evil.
But his death caused them more trouble than his life did.
Oh, absolutely. His death, but that's man. In man's schemes, he's got it all figured out. And if I can do this, then I know what's going to happen. It's all going to be better over there. And this didn't work out for them, did it? What about Satan? Do you think Satan thought he won a victory when Jesus was hanging on the cross? He won. Got rid of that guy. He's dead. Guess what? He was raised from the dead, and through his death, Hebrews 2 and verse 14, and through his resurrection, Romans 1 and verse 4, Satan has been destroyed. Satan thought he had it won, but he didn't. Wes?
Yeah, it really makes me think about perspective in this all. Sometimes we can go through certain things as a result of a past way of life, or sometimes we can be outright attacked by Satan himself. And with having the right perspective and thinking about Hebrews, Hebrews 1, Hebrews 12, where it says, by faith all these things come up, God can use you in a certain way to turn a whole situation around for the betterment.
Well, and that's what God, you know, God took their evil schemes and plots. But little did they know that it was all working into God's plan for this to happen. Real quick, let me introduce you to the theme of the book, or the theme of the chapter, what I think is the theme of the chapter. We obviously aren't going to have time to develop this, but I think the theme of the chapter is the dead shall live. And this is seen from both. Was that first or second? What do I got? That was first, right? Okay. You see this from a physical perspective and from the spiritual perspective. You see it from the physical perspective first, in that Lazarus physically died. All right, so Lazarus is physically dead. Jesus is going to use this occasion not only to deal with Lazarus' physical death, but to talk about it from a spiritual perspective. What's interesting, when you look at the timeline, and you can't nail the timeline down exactly because John 11 doesn't do it. But Lazarus was dead before Jesus ever left Perea, where he was, to go to Bethany. Jesus says in verse 11 and in verse 14, Lazarus is dead, and he hadn't even left the city yet. But when Jesus arrived in Bethany, what is this? I guess it's on the next screen. Sorry, you'll have to catch some of this on online. When Jesus arrived in Bethany, Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. 4 days. So here's Lazarus. Jesus stayed 2 days in Perea after he received message. Then he went 30 miles, which is about a day's journey to get over to Bethany from Perea. Lazarus was already dead before Jesus ever left the city. And in all likelihood, Lazarus was probably dead right after the messengers left to come to Jesus. When the messenger said to Jesus, that he whom you love is sick, the timeline seems to indicate that by that time, Lazarus was already dead. They were 30 miles away. Those messengers had to travel 30 miles. It would have been a good day's journey to get there. And he was probably already dead at that point. So we think, oh, well, Jesus stayed 2 days. Why didn't he rush over and raise him from the dead? He was already dead. But why did Jesus say, what was the purpose that Jesus gave? I'm going to skip through that, sorry. What did Jesus give as the purpose for the raising of Lazarus? It's for the glory of God. Look in verse 4. I have no time at all. Verse 4, he says, the sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. Verse 13, he says, I'm glad I wasn't there so that you might believe. In verse 40 that we've looked at, he said unto Martha, I told you if you would believe, you would see the glory of God. Jesus had raised the dead before, but those people hadn't been dead for 4 days. If somebody is dead for 4 days, is there any question that they're dead? Martha said, Lord, don't open that grave. It's going to be a stench. He's going to stink. He's dead for sure. There's no question that he's dead. Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth. And at the end of time, John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29, Jesus is going to say, all who are in the graves, come forth. Same thing he said to Lazarus. And on that occasion, everybody's going to come forth. The theme of the chapter, the dead shall live. There are some who are spiritually dead and they need spiritual life. But the promise is that all who are dead physically are going to be raised again. And the question is, in eternity, what kind of life are we going to have? You can get this online tomorrow, get the rest of the notes. Read chapter 12 before Wednesday night.